And as you're turning there, I just want to pray, Father, I just ask you to lead us through your word. Father, we trust you. Oh Lord, we trust you to provide the insights that we need. We will never have a full understanding of who you are or a full understanding of your word. But I pray, Father, that tonight as we examine what you've given to us, this truth that is beyond the bounds of human reason, I pray that you'll impart to us what's beneficial for us, what we can take and apply to our lives. I ask you to do this for us, Lord. In Jesus' name, amen. Amen. I'm really worried. It sounds like I'm ready to feedback any second here, just to me and these speakers, but maybe I'm wrong. Is that okay? Can everybody hear me okay? That sounds good right there like that. Okay, Genesis chapter 26. If I were going to title this at all, I would have titled it Well, 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 because we're going to be dealing with a lot of wells tonight. This is the only chapter in the book of Genesis that deals with Isaac specifically and alone. He's come up, you know, several times. Obviously, he was a child of promise. Abraham and Sarah were waiting for him for a long time, and he was dealt with, you know, in connection with Hagar and Ishmael, and he was dealt with on the trek up Mount Moriah when God told Abraham to sacrifice Isaac. But this is our really only glimpse into Isaac's life after the patriarch Abraham, and it's the only chapter really devoted to him in this regard. I don't know what that means. I don't know if we're to infer anything from that, if maybe just his life wasn't all that exciting, or if they're, you know, I don't know that there's anything really to infer from it, except that, you know, Isaac was boring. And I'm just kidding. But we see here how, in this chapter, we're going to see how God's plan carries through and, you know, passes from generation to generation. You know, and it's a beautiful picture in that regard. There's many who discount this chapter, actually say that this isn't a valid chapter in the account here in Genesis, that it was something that was added on much later. They say that the similarities between what we're going to read here and what we read about in earlier chapters in Genesis are too much, that it could never have happened like that. So this was something that was, you know, filled in by later writers to try to give us some idea about Isaac. But really, there is enough that's different in this account that most credible scholars say it can stand on its own, that there's no real problem with determining that this is part of the original intent of the Scriptures. So, of course, I'm just someone who's never comfortable with trying to, you know, clip out parts of the Bible and say, well, that's no good and that's no good, because once you get going with that, where do you stop, you know? And you'll be like Thomas Jefferson, who, what, he had gone through his Bible and clipped out everything that he felt was supernatural, so basically he came up with nothing apart from, you know, genuine leather. So it wasn't quite that bad, but it was basically just a gospel account with no resurrection or whatever. So, I mean, we don't want to do that. We don't want to get into that kind of habit. So to me, God is big, and God is not only big, but he's powerful. And if he's big and he's powerful, then he's well able to preserve for us a word intact the way he wanted us to be able to read it. And that's how come I can include Genesis chapter 26 and not worry about it and really find beautiful truth in here. So let's begin here. We'll read verses 1 through 6 to begin with. Genesis chapter 26. There was a famine in the land, besides the first famine that was in the days of Abraham. And Isaac went to Abimelech, king of the Philistines, in Gerar. And the Lord appeared to him and said, "Do not go down to Egypt and live in the land of which I shall tell you. Dwell in this land, and I will be with you and bless you. For to you and your descendants I give all these lands, and I will perform the oath which I swore to Abraham your father. And I will make your descendants multiply as the stars of the heaven. I will give to your descendants all these lands, and your seed and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws." So Isaac dwelt in Gerar. Well, that's a familiar setup, but we carefully note that even the text itself provides the explanation. This is a separate famine from the famine that Abraham went through before, the famine that came to the land. So we see, though, there's very similar circumstances. And obviously what we have here in this narrative is God is interrupting Isaac's plans to try to go to Egypt. That's the only explanation that seems plausible as to why all of a sudden the Lord is appearing to Isaac saying, hey, don't go to Egypt. Clearly he was packing his bags and putting bumper stickers on there, Egypt or bust, getting ready to go. And God is interrupting him saying, don't go to Egypt. And I want you to remain here where you are. And where he is in the land of the Philistines in this area. And in a time of famine, you know, it would have only made sense to try to go to Egypt or largely populated areas like that. Egypt especially was inviting during a time of famine because you can assume that with that there are times of drought and things like that. So if you can get to the Nile River, which is a fertile plain, you've got an opportunity for water for your animals and things like that, and you've also got the potential of being able to get your crops growing well and stuff. So that would have been the reason why he would have been interested in going in that direction. And so in the process of this, God tells him to stay there in the land where he is. He's going to stay there in the land of the Philistines. And God does something here that to us almost seems like a redundancy, but for Isaac must have been a special event. To us, we see a reiteration of the promise that God gave Abraham. I'm going to bless all the nations through you. Your offspring are going to be like the stars of the sky, etc., etc., etc. And what's amazing about this for our account and for us to look at is that this was the first time God's done this with Isaac. These are all the promises that he gave to Abraham. These are the promises that God spoke to him. But Isaac himself had never heard these things. Obviously, Abraham had told him what it was going to be. Hey, listen, God appeared to me before you were ever born and told me that all this stuff was going to happen. He was going to give us all this land and your descendants are going to be great and blah, 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 blah. And now Isaac is having this same experience. It's not based upon his father's experience. It's not based upon the experience of those who went before him and passed it on to him. Isaac himself is having the same experience, and God himself is appearing to Isaac and letting him know what it was he was going to do with him, going to take place in his life. And that's a wonderful thing to keep in mind, because we realize here that there is no such thing as passing on a promise like that through a generation apart from God divinely interacting with an individual. You know, we've said that story before as young people and stuff. You don't want to make the assumption, well, I go to church, my parents are Christians, so obviously I'm a Christian, I'm growing up in a Christian home. There's no such thing as that. The Lord himself has to be moving in our hearts. We have to know this promise for ourselves. We have to have that relationship and interact with him. No one can actually live off of someone else's experience, and that's true no matter what. And that's true in terms of our coming to these scriptures and understanding them and knowing them. The Lord has to move in our hearts and enlighten our hearts with that, the truths that are here individually. We can't just say, well, I know this, I know that, because, well, Rob mentioned it or has taught on it or whatever. We need to allow the Holy Spirit to move in our own hearts and our own lives and to hear him for ourselves. There's no such thing as living off of someone else's experience that went before us. So Isaac must have been stoked at this, to have God come to him and tell him, hey, this very same thing that I spoke to your dad is going to be happening for you too. So we keep reading here, verses 7 through 11. And the men of the place, that is Gerar, the area around the Philistines, asked about his wife, and he said, she is my sister. For he was afraid to say she's my wife, because he thought, lest the men of this place kill me for Rebekah, because she is beautiful to behold. And that came to pass, when he had been there a long time, that Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked through a window and saw there was Isaac, showing endearment to Rebekah his wife. Then Abimelech called Isaac and said, quite obviously she is your wife. So how could you say she is my sister? Isaac said to him, behold, because I said lest I die on account of her. And Abimelech said, what is this you have done to us? One of the people might have soon have lain with your wife, and you would have brought guilt upon us. So Abimelech charged all his people, saying, he who touches this man's wife or his this man or his wife shall surely be put to death. Thank you. Come again. So what we have here, this is like deja vu. I mean, you know, you read this and it's just like going back to chapter 12 or these earlier accounts. Abimelech, you know, is the same king that Abraham dealt with. And later on, we're going to see that the same commander of his army, I can't remember his name, Philcar, whatever, is dealing with him. And so the question automatically arises, well, how long does this guy live? I mean, you know, this is years and years ago that Abraham was going, this before Isaac was even born. And then the guy's still hanging on, you know, as king of this place and this commander of their army. They're walking around in their walkers and hoping that they can keep the kingdom in order. Clearly, this is a title, much like Pharaoh was a title. So when we're looking at Abimelech, more than likely, we're talking about the royal term for the king. So it has to be a different king, and it has to be a different commander for the army. And that name, more than likely, is a title given to the commander of that army. So it's a different... it's a different guy. And of course, the critics try to refute this all the time, saying, well, it's so similar. Clearly, this was made up by a later author, blah, blah, blah. But to me, it's different enough to take note of. We see, though, that there is a similarity in Isaac's experience and Abraham's experience in that it is fear that's the motivating reason why they end up doing this thing of deceiving the people of the area there with the idea of saying that this is my sister, you know, and so that it preserves the life of the husband. Because obviously the idea is they're going to come in and kill the husband so they can take the lady for themselves. So in order to preserve his own life, he's effecting this ruse to try to fool the people of the land there. It's the same motivating force behind it. It is a fear instead of faith that prompted them both to do this, to make these statements this way, and to try to pass off their relationship as being different than it is. And no matter what, the one consistent that comes through with this, with their ruse, with their plan to deceive, is that it ruins their witness. I mean, you think about it. These guys, you know, these pagan kings look much more righteous than they when they come and confront both Abraham and Isaac, confronting them, saying, what are you guys doing to us? What are you doing to us? We could have been guilty for doing this and not realized it. What have you done to us? And that's a terrible thing to be confronted with. And we kind of dealt with that when Abraham was going through that. But clearly what happened is Abimelech is hanging out there in the palace, and he looks out the window, and there on the park bench, you know, he sees Isaac and what's supposed to be his sister, you know, doing snuggle bunnies on the park bench. And his first thought is, ew, you know, that's his sister. And then it's starting to dawn on him, wait a minute, that's not his sister. And then he goes down there and he talks to them, and of course it comes out, this is what the situation is. And he has to admit that it is his fear that has motivated him, not his faith in the Lord God to protect him. And so clearly, Abimelech, as he's looking at this, is not only disgusted with Isaac for initially making out with his sister, but disgusted with Isaac, just kidding, it wasn't his sister, but anyway, he's disgusted with Isaac because of this lie, and also clearly because he doesn't believe in this God that he seems to be following. Now, it doesn't go as far in this case as it did with Sarah, where she was actually taken in as a wife, and God had to break in on the king and say, you're as good as a dead man if you touch her and stuff. None of that happened. No one actually had taken Sarah to be a wife. And so Abimelech sends out an order. You know, he's nervous about this whole thing. You know, he knows the reputation of Abraham's family, and everybody, I'm sure, in the area remembers what Abraham was able to accomplish when he went out after seven other kings one time. And so there's this sense of respect that they have for him there, and he sends out an order, don't touch this guy's wife. And it's interesting because he doesn't tell Isaac to leave. He doesn't kick him out of the regions of the Philistines. He doesn't say, get out of here. Neither does he invite him to stay. There's just this strange kind of tense toleration that they seem to employ here. And so that leads us into the next section, which is verses 12 through 22. So we keep reading here. Then Isaac sowed in that land, that is the area around the land of the Philistines, and reaped in the same year 100-fold, and the Lord blessed him. The man began to prosper and continued prospering until he became very prosperous, for he had possessions of flocks and possessions of herds and a great number of servants, so the Philistines envied him. Now the Philistines had stopped up all the wells which his father's servants had dug in the days of Abraham his father, and they had filled them with earth. And Abimelech said to Isaac, go away from us, for you are much mightier than we. Then Isaac departed from there and pitched his tent in the valley of Gerar and dwelt there. And Isaac dug again the wells of water which they had dug in the days of Abraham his father, for the Philistines had stopped them up after the death of Abraham. He called them by the names which his father had called them. Also Isaac's servants dug in the valley, and they found a well of running water there. But the herdsmen of Gerar quarreled with Isaac's herdsmen, saying, "The water is ours." So he called the name of the well Esek, because they quarreled with him. Esek means to quarrel. Then they dug another well, and they quarreled over that one also. So he called its name Sitna, which means to despise or to have enmity. And then he moved from there and dug another well, and they did not quarrel over it. So he called its name Rehoboth, for he said, "For now the Lord has made room for us, and we shall be fruitful in the land." Well, here is a place where prosperity is granted by the Lord to Isaac, but I notice that it doesn't come by the hand of anyone else. It's not something that the Philistines loaded him up with to get him out of their land. It's not something that the Egyptians loaded him up with to get him out of their land. But as Isaac was taking a peaceful path, you know, even in the midst of doing something that was deceptive in its process, the Lord's plan is still in effect, and his purpose is to bless Isaac. And so he's blessed, and he has all these crops, and all these things start working for him. And so because he's beginning to grow prosperous in that area, it says the Philistines, you know, are getting envious of him. So their toleration of him hanging out near them is beginning to wear a little bit thin. They're getting a little bit tired of the whole thing. And it comes down to this whole story of these wells. Now, digging a well in that arid country, in that climate like that, in that kind of a place, digging a well was tantamount to laying claim to a land in those days. Because, of course, if you dug a well down in an arid country like that, it was a place where your livestock could all be watered and you could have water, and so you'd settle down there for a while and make yourself at home. You'd kind of basically be a squatter in the area until that water ran out and you'd have to go somewhere else. So when Abimelech and Abraham had their little episode much earlier, remember Abimelech said to Abraham, "You can go anywhere you want around here, you're welcome to hang out, whatever, just, you know, don't bother us, don't let your God kill us," basically was what he was saying. And so when Abraham was there, he dug all these different wells, which in essence, like I said, it was basically like laying claim to those areas. And so when Abraham died, the Philistines went in there and they buried all these wells. They filled them in with water, in essence showing that, look, you know, maybe your dad was allowed to run around here like this, but you're not. You know, your dad was welcome, but you're a different story. You're just a punk kid and we're not sure we want you in our neighborhood. So they're filling in all these places, and it's sort of like, you know, the unwelcome wagon, following them around and filling up all the wells and stopping the wells. And finally it gets to the point where Abimelech sends a word to Isaac saying, "Look, you know, it's time for you to move on. Go find some other place to hang out now." And so Isaac, this is what's cool though. We see one thing that Isaac got from his dad, which is a beautiful characteristic, is there's a meekness here. It doesn't mean he's weak. It doesn't mean he's without power or strength. But there's a meekness and a humility because he doesn't contest this. He doesn't quarrel with Abimelech. We've got to remember who Isaac is at this time. I mean, Isaac is the son of Abraham, and he's got all of these herds. He's basically a traveling city wherever he goes. And he is in command of an army who was able to destroy seven different kings at one time when they went chasing after them on the Lord's command. I mean, Isaac, remember, he's in charge of this same group of people. So there's, I'm sure, even though it's a different group of people now, a different set of them, there's a whole set of Israeli commandos in his entourage as well. So he could very easily have said to his guys, "Look, you know, this guy is stopping up all the wells. It's time for us to go just take over Gerar. We're going to have this whole place for ourselves, and we're going to call it Isaac Town." But instead, he takes the low path. He takes the low roads. I mean, it's really a wonderful demonstration of his humility, and he moves on. He says, "All right, I'll go. I'll take off." And then we have this interesting string of events, and it surrounds around all these wells. Isaac, you know, first he redigs all these wells that Abraham had dug, and those are disputed over immediately. And then he finds this spring-fed well, which was just a valuable prize in that area. You find something like that, it's fed, you know, it's not just something containing water, but the water, there's a spring that's giving it fresh water. They called it living water. And oh man, what a thing to have. And of course, right away, these guys come in saying, "No, no, no, that's ours too." And so he says, okay, he moves on, he finds another well, and they come in saying, no, we want that one as well, as well. And so he goes on, he keeps naming these wells, you know, after the quarrels and the fights they have. Yeah, there's a well of a fight, and this is a well of dispute. But each time, you notice that he's yielding to the one who's disputing with him over the ownership of that. Each time he's yielding to it. He's moving on. Okay, I understand you want this. I'll get out of your hair. He's taking the low road of humility. In actuality, he's taking the high road of humility. And it's an interesting picture of what Isaac did capture from his father in terms of his character. But what Isaac may not have been realizing at this time, when these disputes over these wells were taking place, is that in each one of these disputes, something is moving him closer and closer to the land that God has promised him. These disputes over these wells, each time they came up, kept pushing him closer and closer to the place where God had told Abraham he was giving him all of that area. For Isaac, these wells were a necessity of life. I mean, he needed to have these in order for himself and his crops to survive. And for the Philistines, it was a matter of property ownership. You know, they were looking at it as a land dispute. And for them, it was all about rights and their rights. And so you can see there were two human agencies involved in this. But really what you see is something unseen. And that is God's providential hand moving Isaac through these different disputes, moving him in the direction where God wanted him to go. Because this, while it's humanly explainable, this opposition, there's a divinely ordained means of guidance developing here. Because Isaac seems to have put together this little way of making a determination when he's going to move on. You know, well, when they dispute this well, I'll keep moving. And when they dispute this well, I'll keep moving. And through that, God is pushing him in a direction. God's pushing him in the direction of the promised land that he had given to Abraham, his father. He was pointing towards something else. Now, I think about that. How often in my own life there have been so many wells that I feel like get disputed over. So many wells that get stopped up and I get discouraged and frustrated. I look at it thinking, man, am I ever going to catch a break here? And each time it's moving me in certain directions. Each time I realize in hindsight, God's preparing me, moving me somewhere. He's doing something in the process. You know, it seems explainable on the surface. It seems like we've got a perfectly logical human explanation as to why these things were taking place, why these disputes were happening over and over and over again for Isaac. But what we really have to get a glimpse of is the force of God moving on this, making sure that his will is accomplished. And this is the way in which he was providing this guidance towards something else for Isaac to go where God intended him to be. And that's when we get to verses 23 to 25. Let's read these three verses here. It says at the end of verse 22, "Now the Lord's made room for us. We shall be fruitful in the land." And then we get to verse 23. "Then he went up from there to Beersheba. And the Lord appeared to him that same night and said, 'I am the God of your father Abraham. Do not fear, for I am with you. I will bless you and multiply your descendants for my servant Abraham's sake.' So he built an altar there, and he called on the name of the Lord, and he pitched his tent there, and there Isaac's servants dug a well." These three verses here really are the key verses for understanding what's going on in this whole chapter. Because up to this time, it's the hassles that Isaac is finding at these wells that is the impetus for getting him to move. Up until this point, when there's a dispute over a well, Isaac picks up and he takes off and he moves. And he gets to the next dispute. And that dispute gets him riled up and he gets everything packed up and he moves again. Pushing him in a direction. But now, after finding a well where no one is disputing with him, where he names it, "Hey, God's given us room, man, we finally catch a break here, woohoo!" The very next verse says he picked up from there and left. And there's no explanation as to why he would have done it. Why did he do that? Why would he leave a well where finally it was looking a little bit peaceful for him? He was catching a break in this whole deal. It's possible that a change is taking place in Isaac here. It's possible that something is beginning to dawn on Isaac in this process, because each one of these moves, as I said, has moved him closer to the promised land that God had promised his father. Beersheba is the first place that he and his dad went after the testing that God took Abraham through when he had Abraham take Isaac up on Mount Moriah and told him to sacrifice him there. It's very possible that a change is beginning to take place in Isaac's mind, and And he's beginning to recognize what's happening here in his life. God has been guiding Abraham or Isaac rather through the circumstances of these wells, through the disputes of these wells. God's used that as an impetus to move Isaac in this direction, back to the land where Abraham had walked in fellowship with God. It's possible now that Isaac is sensing on a spiritual level that this is the place that God meant him to be, that this is the place God's been drawing him towards. And so up to this point, circumstances had been driving Isaac this way. And now all of a sudden we find Isaac picking up and seeming to follow a leading to go in a certain direction. I like that. He's following instead of being pushed. He's moving into a land that God had promised he and his father. And he's moving there of his own volition. It wasn't because he was driven there because the circumstances were so bad everywhere else. But he got to a point where suddenly he looked over and there was Beersheba and it began to dawn on him. I believe it's possible that it began to dawn on him. Maybe this is where God wanted me all along. I'll tell you, that is the place that I long to get to, where I'm not just bouncing from circumstance to circumstance and looking back in hindsight saying, oh, I can see now why God brought me here. Duh. I want to get to that place where I'm sensing the move of His Spirit, where I'm recognizing who I am and who I am in light of Him, in light of what He's done for me, in light of how He's brought me into His kingdom. And I'm beginning to sense His moving, and I know on a spiritual level where He wants me to go, what He wants me to do, how He wants me to live, what He wants me to be. And I go there on my own, following Him instead of being driven there by the the cattle prod of circumstances, as I so often am. I want to get to that point. I want to be like that. And this change, if that's what it is that's taking place here in Isaac, this change is bringing about a maturity, and you can see that God's blessing is on it, because as soon as he gets there, suddenly God appears to him. I mean, appears to him and starts reiterating these promises. Hey, you're blessed, man. You are one blessed kid. And all of this is going to happen for you as it was promised even to your father. I just love that. And then verse 25 is wonderful to me because there's a better order to this as you read it, as you look at it. He starts off, he gets to Beersheba, and the first thing he does is he builds an altar. And then he calls on the name of the Lord, and then he pitches his tent, and then his servants go out and they find a well, and they have the provision that they need. Before, he's been running from well to well as circumstances drive him there to try to get what it is that he needs and he's craving and what he feels like he has to have to survive. But finally, instead of being pushed, when he moves on his own volition into this area where he senses the Lord's taking him, the first thing he does is make sure it's all surrendered to God. He builds that altar and he lays it all there before him, saying, "This is yours, God. You lead me. You guide me." He calls on the name of the Lord. He makes sure that that's the very first and foremost thing that his life is about. He's uttering the name of his God, who he's committed his life to. And then he pitches his tent. Then he makes a determination to find a provision for himself in there. And once he's done that, once he's got that order straightened out, and his priorities are right in this, then God comes through with the provision that he needs. Before, he was, like I said, bouncing from place to place, trying to find sustenance. But when he gets this right, when he's surrendering it first to God, then God is providing the water that he has to have. There are so many times that we have this so backwards. I mean, at least I do. You guys don't have to nod or anything, but I get it backwards. There's so many times that I make all of these plans that I think, man, I'm gonna get this worked out and God's gonna bless this and stuff, and I start launching into it, and then halfway through it I'm saying, oh, by the way, Lord, I really need you to bless what I'm doing here. I really need your provision here. Instead of waiting first and surrendering it to the Lord and saying, Lord, what do you want for this and how do you want it to unfold? And I commit this to you. And then when we do that, he's able to bless it. It's the same thing. You know, I'm doing that right now with this building over here. You know, I'm sure you've heard by now there's all these rumors of the possibility we could possibly get the building next to us or whatever. But I'll tell you, I'm so determined to surrender this to the Lord, to allow Him to do whatever He wants to do and bring it to pass the way He wants to bring it to pass, and call on His name and make Him the first priority in this whole thing, that I can trust and have confidence that it's going to work out. He's going to provide for us what we need in terms of room or space or anything like that. The last thing in the world I want to do is go launching off into something and then, you know, try to hit the brakes and say, oh, by the way, God, we really need your blessing on this whole thing. I mean, that would sure be nice. I've had to counsel with people before. I've talked to people who are even in situations living together, and they'll say to me, you know, we want to get this right. We want to make this right, and we want you to make this right for us so that we can get God's blessing on it. I tell you, that's not the way to go about it. If you're a young person, think about that. We don't want to do that. We want to first surrender these things to the Lord. Find out what the Lord is leading us into. Make sure that we're prioritizing Him in all things. And then we can trust that the Lord is going to bless and make the provision that we need. We can trust in His provision that way. Well, let's finish up. Let's read verses 26 to 31 first. Then Abimelech came to him from Gerar with these other guys and the commander of his army. And Isaac said to them, why have you come to me since you hate me and sent me from you? But they said, we certainly have seen that the Lord is with you. So we said, let there now be an oath between us, between you and us, and let us make a covenant with you, that you will do us no harm, since we have not touched you, and since we have done nothing to you but good, and have sent you away in peace. You are now blessed of the Lord. So he made them a feast, and they ate and they drank, and they arose early in the morning and swore an oath with one another, and Isaac sent them away, and they departed from him in peace. Well, here all of a sudden the tables are turned for Isaac. Again, I can't help but notice a contrast here. In the initial stages of this, Isaac's motivated by fear. He's worried about his own life. He's trying to deceive. He's doing things under his own power. And then he's bouncing from well to well, trying to find provision. But when he suddenly stops bouncing from circumstance to circumstance and begins to surrender all of these things, surrender the control of these things to the Lord, and makes the Lord his first priority, look how everything's changed. And now the ones who were antagonistic with him are coming to him wanting to make friends with him, wanting to have a treaty with him. I mean, that's just pretty amazing. Proverbs 16:7 said, when a man's ways please the Lord, he makes even his enemies to be at peace with him. It's interesting to me that all of a sudden this starts happening. And they even make this statement here in verse 29, you are now blessed of the Lord. Why do you say now? It's almost as though it's a contrast between the way he was acting when he was there and lying about his wife and making up stories and stuff and possibly getting everybody in trouble. It's almost as though he's looking at this saying, now we see where your priorities are. Now we see what kind of character you are. We are able to see who you really are. And we're a little bit disconcerted by this. You're blessed of the Lord. This could get us in trouble if we keep disputing with you. And so he wants to, of course, you know, preclude any possible situation where a war could arise because the people of his land are pushing Isaac's people too far. And so he comes and he makes these overtures of peace. And I just love the reality of this. You know, Isaac goes, you know, what are you coming around here for? You hate me. You kicked me out of your place. But it's again, a testimony to his humility. He accepts these overtures of peace. But it is interesting, and I think it's very, very clear in the original text, and many scholars believe that too, that they're able to turn it around, the tables are turned, so that Isaac is sending them away as opposed to them sending Isaac away. And now all of a sudden, Isaac is in a place where he's fortified by the presence of the Lord. He surrenders to the Lord. He prioritizes the Lord. And then he starts concerning himself with his dwelling and allowing the Lord to make provision for him. And in that process, it's as though he's fortified by an unseen presence of God, and even his enemies come to try to make peace with him. It's a beautiful picture there. And then we finish off here with verses 32 to 35. It came to pass the same day that Isaac's servants came and told him about the well which they had dug and said to him, we found water. So he called it Sheba. Therefore the name of the city is Beersheba to this day. When Esau, that's Isaac's son, was 40 years old, he took his wives, Judith, the daughter of Beeri the Hittite, and Basemath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite. And they were a grief of mind to Isaac and Rebekah. Great way to end a chapter with in-law troubles. But it's a beautiful thing to see how God continues his provision, whereas Isaac once was bouncing from well to well. Now there's wells all over the place. You know, the servants are running, saying, hey, we got even more water, everything's great. And we see then, you know, it's reinforced how God provides, how God will provide when we surrender to him. And then, of course, Esau, it's this account of how he marries two Canaanite women. That's building up towards chapter 27, where we see, you know, what's transpiring here with Esau. We see how Romans 9 really kind of fits in all of this, how the Apostle Paul is able to make sense of it. You know, before having done either good or evil, one was chosen, the other was rejected. And we see how Esau's life is being lived out here. He's not willing, clearly, to follow his dad's command, because his dad gives commands in chapter 27 that you're not to marry the women of this area. Clearly, Esau's run ahead, made sure he got himself a wife, not just a wife, two wives in the area, and they're a grief of mind to his parents. And of course, you know, it means that they're just a, you know, they're a hassle to him. They're distressed by his choice. They're distressed by these Canaanite women now part of the family. You know, they're going to be at all the gatherings, Thanksgiving, the whole deal. And so they're stressed by that. And we'll pick up the story then in what transpires now as the story, the narrative is going to shift over to the story of Jacob and our little deceiver who carries a promise. Very interesting story.